Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston. Hey, you still think Americans are blaming Democrats for the MAGA Republican government shutdown? Really? Please subscribe to the show wherever you are listening and give it a good 5-star review and subscribe to Left of Lansing on the YouTube as well. Follow me on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, and the Gram. And of course, let me know what you think about the show or what you didn't like about it. And maybe you have an idea or two of someone maybe you think I should have on a future episode, or maybe there's a topic you think I should really be bringing up, contact me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. So I'm recording this episode on Wednesday, November 5th, around 18 hours or so after all of the election results from this past Tuesday came in, and I'm really having a tough time, everyone, reaching a conclusion other than this election could not have turned out any better for Democrats. I can't come with an argument saying, oh, no, it could have been better. No, I don't see how. I mean, it really couldn't have been a better night for Democrats. Obviously, on a national level, which we'll talk more about here in a bit, Democrats and progressive policies and movements had a really great night. I mean, big wins for Abigail Spanberger, a 3-time congresswoman, a former CIA officer, who now also becomes the first woman to become Virginia's governor. Spanberger defeated her nutty MAGA Republican opponent by 14 points or so. Also a Democrat won the lieutenant governor's race there, as well as the attorney general's race, despite some controversial tweets by the Democratic candidate, which just goes to show the anti-Trump feeling that was pervasive throughout this election. And Virginia Democrats gained somewhere between 10 to 13 seats to further cement their majority in the House of Delegates, which means Virginia Democrats will pass a bill to add another Democratic congressional seat to counter what MAGA Republican state legislatures across the country are doing as they find ways to continue to cheat to remain in power. And maybe this is expected since the MAGA Republican government shutdown has left some 1.5 million government workers either furloughed or working without getting paid, many of them living in Virginia. And let's not forget what Dear Leader and Elon Musk did when they slashed government jobs earlier in the year while granting themselves massive tax breaks. I'll be darned if Virginians weren't happy. And Spanberger concentrated on that issue as well as how tariffs hurt the state of Virginia as well. In New Jersey, Congresswoman and former Navy co-pilot Mikey Sherrill defeated her MAGA opponent by some 12 to 13 points, which was larger than pollsters predicted. Again, I don't know how much we should really be investing in all these polls, which continue to seem like they're getting it wrong each and every election season, at least of late. Again, Mikey Sherrill concentrated on some core economic issues like cost of living, housing expenses, expensive electricity rates, working class issues. In Pennsylvania, voters in the Keystone State, which voted for Dear Leader Trump last year, voted to ensure liberals would keep their 5-2 edge on the state Supreme Court, a victory for democracy. In Maine, voters not only passed an initiative to make Maine the 22nd state to have an extreme risk protection gun law, also known as a red flag law, something we have here in Michigan, but Maine voters also voted against instituting draconian MAGA voter ID laws. In Colorado, voters there passed a ballot proposal that raises taxes on some of the state's highest earners, those making over $300,000 per year, to fund school meals for children. Again, something that we're doing here in Michigan, and I'm talking about free meals for public school children. Now, that vote, that particular vote in Colorado, that caught my eye since I recently spoke with Jess Newman of the Invest in My Kids ballot proposal that's seeking to levy a 5% surcharge on Michigan's top earners so that way we could raise here in the state around $1 billion per year for Michigan public schools. They're collecting signatures right now, and if it gets on the ballot, I have a good feeling that it will pass next year. I mean, it appears that working class voters are supporting initiatives that champion fairness. In Georgia, Democrats flipped a pair of seats on the state's Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities, kind of like, you know, Michigan's Public Service Commission in a way. You might be asking yourself, though, okay, Pat, now why is that newsworthy? And it's a fair question. Maybe it's because it's the first time since 2000 that a Democrat in Georgia has won a Public Service Commission race, according to the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. Pretty big. Also in Mississippi, Democrats won a race to break the MAGA Republican supermajority in that state's legislature. That happened in Mississippi this week. And of course, in New York City, history was made when 33-year-old Zoran Mamdani, who's a two-term Democratic Socialist incumbent on the New York City Assembly, dismantled and discarded the Democratic establishment by soundly defeating former, quote-unquote, Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo and also a MAGA Republican on the ballot. He received over 50% of the vote in that three-person race. Cuomo, of course, received a late endorsement by Dear Leader Trump, proving how similar each of them really have always been. And I'm not just talking about the sexual assault stuff. I'll have more to say about Zoran Mamdani's victory here in just a moment, because I have to focus first here on Michigan, and particularly in Detroit, because for the first time in Detroit's history, a woman will be that city's mayor. Not that there was a whole lot of speculation leading into that mayoral election where Mary Sheffield, who's been the president of the Detroit City Council, routed her right-wing opponent, Reverend Solomon Kinloch Jr., by some 50 points. Steve Neeling from the Detroit Metro Times wrote the following as to why Kinloch's campaign was basically always a non-starter. And he says that Kinloch faced mounting scrutiny over delinquent water bills, property tax issues, his church's real estate dealings, his $1.3 million mansion in Royal Oak Township, residency requirements, and a conviction for assaulting his first wife with a butcher knife. Seemed like a great guy. Still, Sheffield would now become the city's youngest mayor at the age of 38. And give Mary Sheffield credit for running an effective campaign in which she garnered the support of so-called centrists, like current Governor Mike Duggan, who's running as an independent to become governor, even though he's now being backed by big-time corporate MAGA dollars. But Mary Sheffield also garnered support from unions, from independents, from Democrats, and progressive Democrats on the city council as well. And as Steve Neeling wrote throughout the campaign, Mary Sheffield continued to call for more affordable housing, economic equity, and government transparency, pledging to prioritize neighborhoods that have been left behind by downtown development. She also called for strengthening police accountability and improving social services. And Mr. Neeling also points out that during her Detroit City Council presidency tenure, Mary Sheffield was always a vocal critic of inequitable investing strategies, calling a shift away from tax incentives for downtown developers and towards policies that directly benefit Detroit's most vulnerable residents. She also supported Vermont Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2020. So that's where maybe she wants to do some things differently than Mike Duggan. Mike Duggan really loved those multi-million dollar tax incentives for downtown developers to help build up the downtown while the rest of Detroit sort of just sat there. I like to play a part of Mary Sheffield's victory speech because she not only talks about the historical significance of her victory, especially since her grandfather is the late Horace Sheffield Jr., a civil rights and working rights icon, but Mary Sheffield accentuated how she wants to help the working class in Detroit. Listen.
So over the past 330 days, we've built a more than a campaign, we built a movement. A movement that has proven that we are stronger when we all stand together as one Detroit. I've seen it on the east side, the west side, and every block in between. Neighbors that are organizing block by block, our small businesses that are lifting up our communities, and our young people who are demanding a future that they can believe in. This is the spirit of our city. The spirit that carried us here to this moment in Detroit. Let's not forget who we are. Yeah. We are a city of innovators, of champions, of change makers. We put the world on wheels. We created the Motown sound. We built the nation's first public highway. We powered the arsenal of democracy. And from these Detroit streets came freedom. From the Underground Railroad to the fight for civil rights. This is the home of the labor movement. The birthplace of America's middle class. And nearly 60 years ago, my grandfather, Horace Sheffield Jr., stood on the front lines during the walk to freedom, demanding jobs, dignity, and justice for every Detroiter. And now, almost six decades later, his granddaughter stands right here. Ready, equipped, and prepared to continue that fight for all Detroiters. Detroit, this is the great spirit of our city. A spirit that is alive and well tonight, which is why I know that we will rise higher.
You know, I have hope for Mary Sheffield, but if there's something else that I believe is just as important for Sheffield, it's ensuring that she gets stuff done to help Detroit's neighborhoods rather than constantly focusing on downtown development, and how much corporate welfare we can continue to hand out to greedy developers. Because Detroit's voting numbers, they could be better. They really could. I mean, it seems like there's lots of voter apathy in Detroit since the people feel like they aren't being heard or that their problems aren't being addressed. And I get it. I mean, if I were Mary Sheffield, I'd do what I can to ensure that not only her administration become a presence on the east and west sides of Detroit, but that she maybe brings Democrats from Lansing and from D.C. to Detroit as well. Because if Democrats are going to win Michigan, they've got to win Detroit. Detroiters have to feel like they're being represented and heard. That means not only do Democrats have to be present there, but that also entails that Mary Sheffield and the Detroit City Council must pass policies that will help improve the lives of working class Detroiters. And Detroiters have to feel like they are being represented and heard. And maybe that's why we saw another glimmer of hope this week from the Detroit elections. Denzel McCampbell, who works for our good friends at Progress Michigan, will have to leave that job though at Progress Michigan because he's going to be on the District 7 seat of the city council. Congratulations, Denzel. Even more importantly, McCampbell will become the second Democratic Socialist on the Detroit City Council, joining Gabriela Santiago Romero, who also won her re-election. So congratulations to both. Now, last week, I highlighted a portion of an interview that I had with Mr. McCampbell when he visited our show last August to talk about his campaign. And he talked about why now, more than ever, someone is needed in Detroit to represent the people, to put people first. And Denzel McCampbell said the Trump regime and MAGA Republicans in D.C. and also in Lansing are continuously scheming to cut essential services that working class Detroiters deserve. Just like how they're trying to gut essential programs and services that all of us in the working class deserve. Denzel McCampbell defeated four-term State Representative Karen Whitsett, who still comically labeled herself as a Democrat, but that was just a name only. Karen Whitsett illustrated what is really wrong with Lansing politics. I mean, she decided to join the MAGA side during the pandemic and then voted to stop state Democrats from ending the ridiculous 24-hour waiting period for a woman to get abortion care, although that was later made into law by a court. But Karen Whitsett also prevented women on Medicaid to receive abortion care. She also joined State House Republicans last year in preventing essential bills from being passed in the State House while Democrats still had power during the lame duck session. And then she voted for the MAGA Michigan Matt Hall budget bill that needlessly cut public education, crime prevention programs, and more. Thankfully, a lot of that was pushed back by the Democratic Senate when both sides finally agreed to a state budget last month. But here was my favorite. Karen Whitsett also failed to show up for numerous votes in the State House because Karen said she had to take care of her dog. Look, I'm a dog person and owner, and I get needing to care for your dog. Don't get me wrong. But then don't run for state representative. Leave it to somebody else. And that was such a cop-out because she wasn't there to serve the people. She was just there to serve herself. And that's why Denzel McCampbell defeated Karen Whitsett in a close primary last August. And that's why he beat Karen Whitsett this time by 20 points in the general election. Detroiters in the 7th District understood that she was out there just for herself. You know, kind of like Andrew Cuomo. And like I said, the other Democratic socialist on the Detroit City Council, Gabriela Santiago Romero, also defeated a state representative in her election. When you represent the people, when you champion their causes, when you champion progressive populism, the people will back you. Now, I understand that McCampbell and Santiago Romero only represent 2 seats on the Detroit City Council. However, that's how movements begin. And you know what? There will be some votes when their votes will be needed to pass certain resolutions. And that's why I always say, pay attention to local politics, everyone. Please do, because that's where change happens faster. So congrats on your upset victory, Denzel McCampbell. Now, I'd just like to note that in Lansing, Democratic Mayor Andy Shore easily won re-election with 66% of the vote, defeating progressive challenger Kelsey Hector, who garnered 33% of the vote. Kelsey was kind enough to appear here on the show and talk about her platform a couple of months ago. Now, Shore's victory was to be expected, but for Kelsey Hector to basically pull in 33% of the vote despite no big corporate backing or big money donor backing is impressive in my book. That tells me that her message did resonate with a good chunk of the people there in Lansing. And Kelsey brought to light many of the daily struggles that working class people in Lansing are experiencing, some of whom cannot afford housing. And here's the thing, Kelsey Hector has been involved with the Lansing community for years, and she will continue to do so. She will continue to be a voice for the voiceless. And I have a feeling this is just the start for Kelsey Hector's political career. Kelsey focused on the working class and talked with the people in her community to understand what is most affecting them on a daily basis. Kelsey talked with people, not to people. Detroit's Denzel McCampbell talked with people of the 7th District there in Detroit. He didn't talk to people. He talked with people. And that's essentially what Zoran Mamdani did in New York City. And that's why it's easy to understand why he won in impressive fashion against Andrew Cuomo, the Cuomo family, the Democratic Party establishment, the corporate authoritarians who showered Cuomo with campaign bribes, the Trump regime who made deals with current mayor Eric Adams to leave the race, Dear Leader Trump himself, who personally backed Cuomo, and of course, the corporate media. That's what Zoran Mamdani was facing, and he beat them all.
A podcast devoted to intelligence, sanity, and freedom, or otherwise known as progressive politics. It's Left of Lansing with your host, Pat Johnston. Need to tell Pat where he's wrong? Or do you actually want to praise Pat? Leftoflansing@gmail.com is how to reach him. Here's Pat.
I'd like to play this clip from Mamdani's victory speech on Tuesday night. And again, you will hear how he brings everyone together, the entire working class together, by pointing out how we are all on the same playing field while the billionaire donor class and the Trump regime work to tear us all apart. Listen.
So Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have 4 words for you. Take Trump to evade taxation and exploit tax breaks. We will stand alongside unions and expand labor protections because we know, just as Donald Trump does, that when working people have ironclad rights, the bosses who seek to extort them become very small indeed. New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant. So hear me, President Trump, when I say this. To get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us.
If you're wondering why some 26 billionaires spent millions to try to defeat Mamdani, well, there you go right there. And I have to say, if they've got that kind of cash to spend on elections, well, then I think they can pay a little bit more in taxes to help the rest of us, right? Again, it's all about fairness. And by the way, I kind of think the crowd there gravitated to what he's saying. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was just me. What do you think? You know, if you haven't gotten the chance to watch the entire speech, please do. Not just because it was perfectly given, but it is one of the most pro-working class, pro-populist, pro-American speeches that I've heard in quite some time. And what I loved about that speech is that Mamdani went on full attack mode against the Trump regime, and he showed no fear in the face of fascism. You know, after Trump won last year, we noticed a lot of Democrats suddenly capitulate, which put the working class on notice. Now, some of the themes that Mamdani hit in his speech and also during his entire campaign is how new faces, new leadership, and new ideas are needed to save the entire working class. Yes, he focused on affordability, which, you know, I have to say, is funny now because at first, so-called centrist and moderate or establishment Democrats denounced that part of Mamdani's campaign. But then after his primary victory over Cuomo, you heard many of them suddenly start using the term affordability. Trump said affordability many times during his entire campaign last year, and now he's fighting to block millions and millions of Americans from getting their food assistance. Again, did you ever really believe Donald Trump was going to do one thing, lift one finger to make things more affordable for working class Americans? I mean, he's fighting to keep the insane tariff schemes that are crushing small businesses. He celebrated forcing work requirements on millions of Americans to receive their Medicaid assistance, while his MAGA Republicans in Congress refused to work by keeping the government shut down. You know, on the flip side, yeah, I'm hearing Democrats talk affordability now, but I'm not hearing many establishment Dems suggest any real policies or ideas to counter what MAGA Republicans are doing. But Mamdani, you see, he talked about rent freezes. He talked about free public transit. He talked about free childcare, which is costing families enormously. And he also talked about ending government and corporate corruption. That meant ending corruption in both the Democratic Party establishment circles and the Trump regime. Mamdani's triumph, everyone, was a triumph not just against hate-filled MAGA politics and Dear Leader Trump, but it was a triumph against the Democratic Party establishment, which decided to either back Andrew freaking Cuomo or choose to say nothing at all, Chuck Schumer. I mean, here's Mamdani not only highlighting the lack of affordable housing and quality jobs, while also proposing ways to use government to help working class Americans. He ran an effective campaign, effective and an affirmative campaign with real policies designed to help people. And then there was Andrew Cuomo, sounding very much like a MAGA Republican by resorting to Islamophobia, blatant and sickening Islamophobia. But Andrew Cuomo didn't propose any policies to help improve the lives of New Yorkers. Andrew Cuomo's strategy was to say, yeah, I know I suck, but did you know that the other guy really, really sucks more? How many times have we watched Democrats fall into that same trap of refusing to drive the narrative filled with ideas and policies and instead attack the opponent? Hey, orange man bad, vote for us. Yeah, far too often. As Eric Blanc on his Labor Politics Substack wrote, this was a referendum on the future of the Democratic Party, and the establishment lost badly. Yes, it did. Zoran Mamdani also won in a city that's not real known for electing progressive mayors. Eric Blanc had to remind us that three of the four mayors, Rudy Giuliani, Michael Bloomberg, and Eric Adams, were not progressive at all. As Eric wrote, Americans are feeling the pinch everywhere, and overcoming MAGA requires us to point that anger upward against corporate America so that it doesn't instead get channeled downward against immigrants and trans kids. And that's the part that I loved the most about Mamdani's campaign and his victory speech last night. It punched upwards, not downwards. You can protect the working class, advocate for the working class, push policies that'll advance the working class without having to divide or sacrifice part of the working class. Mamdani said in his speech that for far too long, populism gained favor on the right wing of our politics. And I'd even say the extreme authoritarian right wing of our politics. But it hasn't made lives better. Attacking the LGBTQ plus community hasn't made lives better. Attacking the trans community specifically hasn't made lives better. Oh, it's made the lives of the corporate tech bro authoritarians better. It's made the lives of white Christian nationalist dude bros and wannabe trad wives better. But it's not improving the working class, and it's not improving our society. I mean, ABC News reports today that Americans' household debt levels, including mortgages, car loans, credit cards, and student loans, are now at a new record high, according to data released by the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And the corporate media and establishment Democrats and MAGA Republicans are still dumbfounded as to why Zoran Mamdani not only won big in New York City, but why he's popular with many Democratic base voters across the nation and many independent voters across the nation. Populism, everyone, populism won this week. And before you can argue, but Pat, moderates won in Jersey and Virginia, stop it. True, I don't know if Mamdani wins a statewide race with his message or not. I don't. It hasn't really been tried outside of Bernie Sanders. However, as I said, Mikey Sherrill in Jersey and Abigail Spanberger in Virginia still talked up affordability issues, which is populism. What Mamdani, though, did differently, and something that is anathema to both the Democratic Party establishment and the MAGA Republican Party, is that he went on the offense by proposing bold working class policies. He made establishment Democrats and MAGA Republicans and the MAGA Republican media intelligentsia grifter machine have to react to his ideas, have to react to his policies. You see, he took the battle to them, and they hated it because he pointed at the corporate authoritarian billionaire class as the problem. He didn't point at a book containing two lesbian characters in a school library. He pointed at the billionaire class, and they hated it. And you know what? It's a damn shame that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama decided to sit this one out. They chose to be careful. I mean, so much for shattering the glass ceiling, eh, Hillary? And so much for the audacity of hope, eh, Obama? Yeah, Bill Clinton backed Cuomo as well, and, well, that says a lot too, doesn't it? Another reason why Mamdani won in such easy fashion is that he took the battle to Trump and to the Trump regime. As you just heard in that speech, Mamdani attacked the regime's authoritarianism and said that if you want to get to them, meaning immigrants, then you'd have to go through all of us. That was the best line of the speech because the line was a battle cry for the entire working class, not just for New York City, but for the working class of the United States of America. That was patriotism. We are all part of the same class, and it's a class the regime and the corporate overlords want to keep shoving down. If we allow them to abuse one group, then they'll go after another group. Capitulation is never an option. I'll repeat, capitulation is never an option. I mean, that's why I still have no idea what Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer is waiting for or what her strategy is. As the progressive social media poster known as Extreme Michigan released this week, Governor Whitmer hasn't given speeches or shown any real support for the immigrant community in the state. She hasn't condemned the Trump regime for releasing his ICE Gestapo on citizens, undocumented, documented, or full American citizens. She hasn't condemned the ICE kidnapping detention facility up there in Baldwin. Whitmer hasn't given speeches about Dear Leader's authoritarian grab of our country's institutions. In fact, she's never even used the term oligarchy or authoritarianism since the regime took over last winter. Whitmer did criticize Dear Leader over his tariffs, and I guess, you know, she couldn't really avoid doing that since those tariffs are devastating our state's economy, and it's also devastating us in terms of seeing a drop in Canadian citizens visiting our state. And, unfortunately, I don't believe we have seen Governor Whitmer attend one protest rally ever since the Trump regime got back into power. If I'm wrong, let me know, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Populism won this week. And for the life of me, I just don't understand why it's impossible for some establishment Democrats to get that through their heads. Take Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Haley Stephens, for instance, okay? Now, she's running to become the next United States Senator after current Senator Gary Peters retires next year. And Stephens is running against progressive Dr. Abdullah Syed and Democratic State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who's also, I would say, to the left of Stephens. It's not a secret that Stephens takes corporate PAC money, not a secret whatsoever. And she also has taken money from the right-wing American-Israeli lobby known as AIPAC. So I just played Mamdani's victory speech, a portion of it there for you. Compare that speech to this clip of Haley Stephens from WKAR's Off the Record with Tim Skubick show. This was from last week. The Detroit News' Craig Mauger asks Haley Stephens, I think, a pretty easy question for Stephens to answer. And well, it doesn't go well, but listen for yourself.
Do you think large corporations have too much influence in politics right now?
I think the voice of the people is very important. And
so is that a yes or no?
I don't necessarily view it like that.
Why not? I mean, this is a lot of energy on the Democratic side right now is on this.
Well, what would be an example of that, Greg?
Well, I was going to ask you that.
Here's the thing. I field 50,000 phone calls a year from constituents. I take my cues from people who are calling my office to get help. I've returned millions of dollars to the pocketbooks of Michiganders. That is who I serve.
I think some of your opponents would say an example is healthcare costs are through the roof for average Michigan residents. The healthcare industry gives buckets of money to the people who set the policies. Why isn't anything being done here?
Well, people don't want to see their healthcare prices increase. Look, I've worked very hard in the Congress to lower the cost of prescription drugs. I would say that we have got to protect access to affordable healthcare, you know, every step of the way.
Haley Stephens could not denounce or condemn corporate PAC money because she sees she's relying on it more than the other two candidates. And by the way, I cut off her answer there because she spends the next 30 to 45 seconds going down some route talking about why we can't have Medicare for all. Haley Stephens just illustrated to every Democratic base voter in Michigan how willing she is to get the corporate shilling, but they also learned that she's not in this for them. I mean, not only did Haley Stephens refuse to criticize the influence of corporate PAC money, she couldn't even communicate effectively why she believes corporate PAC money is good. I mean, if you can't even give an answer to why it's bad, at least give me an argument why you think it's good. I mean, you want to understand why polling numbers are dismal for Democratic Party leaders? It's because they back someone vacuous like Haley Stephens. Now, there is a good battle going on between Abdullah Syed and Mallory McMorrow for this Democratic Senate primary. Haley Stephens must get out because she's getting destroyed on a daily basis. She will lose that seat for Democrats if she gets the nomination. But this is who the D.C. Democratic establishment is backing. It's that person you just heard. You know, I have to agree with Jared Yates Sexton and Daniel Moody with something they said on their show. It's called The Check-In. It's an online show. And they said that Mamdani won because we saw normal working class New Yorkers stand together and fight against fascism. We weren't watching billionaires. We weren't watching consultants from the parties. We were watching normal working class everyday New Yorkers stand together. And Jared Yates Sexton and Danielle Moody also said that he won because he didn't try to sound like a cheap recording of a DC consultant or a cheap recording of DC consultant talking points. Namdani won because he took the battle to the Trump regime and he articulated a coherent and cohesive policy strategy to improve the lives of millions. As our good friends from the Still Social, Michigan's progressive independent media source, said this morning, from New York to Michigan, voters chose people over profit, community over corruption, and neighbors over name tags on corporate headquarters. The 2025 election, they said, was not just a blue wave, it was a reckoning. And the message was loud and clear, democracy still belongs to us. It was a reckoning, I agree. It was a progressive reckoning, and most of all, it was a populist reckoning. I need a drink of water, and I need a break. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
Just wanted to mention two more quick items on this election. First, I found these exit polls that showed that young men voted for Democratic candidates by pretty large margins. Spanberger in Virginia won 18 to 29-year-old men 57 to 42%. And in New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill won them 56 to 44%. That's pretty good. Mamdani, of course, the Democratic Socialist, got 68% of young men. And all three Democrats got over 80% of young women. So that seems kind of important because if Democrats are going to indeed have a blue tsunami next year, well, they not only have to win over younger voters, but they've got to win over younger voters in big numbers. Now, I'm not surprised that Mamdani, Spanberger, and Sherrill each earned around 80% of the young women's vote. I am very happy, though, to see that both Spanberger and Sherrill won the young male vote by a healthy margin, and that's not to be discounted considering the misogyny in this country and how Democrats have not been really great at capturing the young male vote, or at least they didn't do well last year, which is why I'm really excited to see that Mamdani got 68% of young men in New York to back him. I'm wondering why. Why did young men vote for Mamdani in such significant numbers? Could it be that his campaign and his policy ideas encouraged them to go out and vote for him? You know, at a time when Democrats were losing the youth vote, perhaps they should wonder why Mamdani did so well. But it's pretty easy to understand. And second, to give you a clue that establishment Democrats still are not getting it, I'm seeing that Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell just can't see the obvious, or she's saying whatever her donors want her to say. Because when asked about the attacks that Republicans are lobbing at Mamdani, including calling him a Muslim terrorist, CNN's Brianna Keller asked Dingell if she's concerned with those Republican attacks. And Debbie Dingell responded with, and I'm quoting, "I'm going to focus on the election of Abigail Spanberger, who is clearly a moderate, as is Mikey Sherrill, both women that had strong military and national intelligence backgrounds." The 71-year-old Debbie Dingell has had a fine career and legacy in Washington, but it's time to step down, Debbie. No, I'm not mad that she wants to also celebrate Spanberger and Sherrill's victory. Of course she should do that. I am upset that Debbie Dingell didn't use that moment to attack the MAGA Republicans' blatant Islamophobia when it comes to Mamdani. She just let that one slide. Just let it slide. And that is entirely weak, and that is why so many people would like new faces within the Democratic Party. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. I need to share just a couple of thoughts on the death of Dick Cheney, who died this week at the old age of 84. As somebody who was in his 20s during the 2000s, I got to experience how Dick Cheney really did move the political needle in this country, and he moved it for the worse. Before becoming the most powerful vice president ever, since George W. Bush didn't have half his brain, Dick Cheney got kicked out of Yale twice due to bad grades and had a couple of drunk driving arrests. I mean, I guess then we can't be too surprised that Pete Hegseth would eventually become defense secretary following in the footsteps of Dick Cheney. Although I don't think Pete ever had drunk driving arrests. Oh, and lest we forget that, like Dear Leader Trump, Dick Cheney somehow slithered away from having to serve in the Vietnam War. Cheney said that he had other priorities than military service at that time. He said that, and you can look it up. He had other priorities than military service at that time. Yeah, as did the over 50,000 Americans who died in Vietnam, Dick, as did they. Thanks to his connections, though, and his love for being a neoconservative who loved war, he just didn't want to fight on them, that's when Dick Cheney became a Wyoming congressman, where he would vote against Martin Luther King Day, where he would support apartheid in South Africa, where he opposed Head Start, among other glorious votes. But then he slithered his way once again through the power corridors of Washington, becoming the Secretary of Defense for George H.W. Bush, and then essentially picking himself to be Bush's son, George W.'s vice presidential pick in 2000. And that's where he would help engineer one of the greatest election steals of all time, as the right-wing Supreme Court would vote Bush-Cheney into power. But it was 9/11. That changed everything and everything for the worse. And Dick Cheney, who always dreamed of a huge neocon war effort in the Middle East, well, he was not going to let that tragedy go to waste. No, no, no. And so he helped engineer one of the greatest fabricated stories or lies to help get the United States into war with Iraq. I mean, he claimed that Iraq's dictator, Saddam Hussein, had weapons of mass destruction, only there was no evidence to support such claims, and no weapons of mass destruction were ever found. But at the time, in the run-up to the war, the legacy media went along with it, and America got mired into a long war, which cost nearly 4,500 American lives. The war sent the entire Middle East into chaos, and it ended up costing the United States around $3 trillion. Just remember that when you're told that we can't afford Social Security or Medicare for all. Oh, but we had no problem spending $3 trillion for a war in Iraq. What's worse is that Dick Cheney never apologized for lying to the American people about the Iraq war. And combine that with his lifelong desire to create a stronger and more secretive executive branch. And well, Dick Cheney paved the way for someone like Donald Trump to walk in the office and act like an authoritarian. Sure, in his old age, Dick Cheney opposed Trump and even voted for Kamala Harris in the last presidential election of his life. But he did that strictly because Donald Trump had taken complete power over Cheney's Republican Party, and he went after Dick Cheney's daughter. Cheney used 9/11 for his war on terror program, which included torture, mass surveillance, and the arrest of innocent civilians. Hey, does that sound familiar to anybody out there? Cheney once even declared that the government would have to work on the dark side after 9/11, spending time in the shadows of the intelligent world. It should be remembered that when he wasn't inside the government, Dick Cheney served as the CEO of Halliburton, which was an engineering company for big oil companies, and he made millions as that CEO, which is why it really wasn't a leap to conclude that his Middle East wars would help feed the oil companies' bank accounts. I know, we're not supposed to speak ill of the dead, but at least Dick Cheney got to live to be a very old man, while thousands upon thousands died as young men or women because of his actions. Islamic scholar Omar Suleiman said of Dick Cheney, "May the 1 million murdered souls of Iraq haunt you for eternity." I'm sure they will. However, here in the living world, Dick Cheney's actions will continue to haunt us for years to come, as we're seeing with Donald Trump in the White House.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Well, Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Coming up next week, Livingston County progressive activist, social media commentator and podcaster, and also a good friend of the show, Casey Helton, will talk about what's happening in Livingston County politics. Of course, we'll also cover politics across the state and across the nation. I mean, I will want to get her take on what we saw happen this week. And Casey is also up to date on this fight over this construction of a new data center around Howell and why it's got lots of citizens, including herself, standing up to block it from ever being built. So I'm looking forward to catching up with Casey Helton next week. Tell me what you think of the show by emailing me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Please share the show with other like-minded individuals who might find this pretty entertaining. Or at least somewhat informative, I don't know. But that's the best way I can get this show out to as many people here across Michigan and across the nation is by your help. And I have to tell you that as a sports fan, I'm not real thrilled with this fight between Disney and Google. I mean, I've got YouTube TV, but Disney's playing hardball and has blocked all Disney channels on YouTube TV, including ESPN and ESPN2, which means I might miss CMU football next week. But, you know, it's okay. I'm finding other things to watch as these two corporate titans figure out how best to bilk the customer. What was it Tom Petty once said? The boys upstairs want to see how much you'll pay for what you used to get for free. Ain't that the truth? And no Christmas decorations until at least after Veterans Day, people. Come on, that should be a law. Until next week, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.